Good afternoon. I'd like to call this meeting of the House Resources Committee to order. The time is 1:03 p.m. Members present at this time, Representative Chris Tuck, Representative Sarah Hannon, Representative Dave Tellerico, Representative Ivy Sponholz, Representative George Rauscher, Representative Sarah Rasmussen, Vice Chair Representative Greyer Hopkins, Co-Chair Representative John Lincoln, and myself, Representative Tarr. Please let the record reflect that we do have a quorum to conduct business. If we could please ask folks as we get started to silence your cell phone, we'd appreciate that. Assisting us today is our recording secretary, Ms. Debbie Tillinghast, and our LIO moderator, Amanda Kraft. Thank you to both of you for your help. Today we have two items. The first is House Bill 27, Regulation of Flame Retardant Chemicals, and then that'll be followed by a presentation on petroleum fiscal policy by Rich Ruggiero and Christina Ruggiero. Nice to see both of you. And we're not going to move the bill out today, but we are going to get a refresher on it for hopeful action on Wednesday. So we're going to start with House Bill 27. If Carla from my office wants to come forward. And we do have a committee substitute for this, so I was looking for a motion to adopt the committee substitute.
Yes, Madam Co-Chair, I move the committee substitute for House Bill 27, version 31-LS0198/S be adopted as our working document.
Madam Chair, I'll object for the purpose of discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, and thank you, Representative Rasmussen. And Carla from my office, if you would like to put yourself on the record. And the plan here, since we heard this bill last year, but it's been a while, is to just do a brief introduction and then go through the changes in the CS. So hopefully that'll just refresh our memory of what the bill is. Thank you.
My name is Carla Hart. I'm staff to Representative Garen Tarr, and I'm speaking on HB 27. Do I have to write my phone there? Flame retardants are throughout our homes and offices, in keyboards, furnishings, mattresses, and electronics. Loosely bound in plastics and foam, they are spread as dust. The dust is inhaled and ingested. Children playing on the floor ingest a disproportionate amount as their little hands capture dust that is transferred to their mouths. When you eat finger food while at your keyboard or in your car, you are almost certainly eating microscopic particles of flame retardants with your chips or fruit. These toxins go into your bloodstream. Evidence suggests exposure to flame retardants and PFAs before birth may impair children's cognitive and behavioral development. I shared a neuroscience news article from January 14th with your office on Tuesday. Their summary, exposure to flame retardants and pesticides resulted in more than a million cases of intellectual disability in children between 2001 and 2016. However, adverse outcomes from exposure to mercury and lead fell significantly during the same period. Mercury and lead harm decreased because of restrictions placed into law. While we cannot and should not experiment on humans to isolate risks and dangers in a rigorous scientific manner, studies on animals have disturbing findings. Perinatal exposure, for humans, perinatal is the 20th to 28th weeks of gestation up to a month after birth, in rats and mice permanently reprograms liver metabolism, often leading to later in life to insulin resistance and non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. There are more studies than I have time to read or list. I'm happy to get information to you in response to specific questions. Widespread use of smoke detectors, improved building codes, fire-safe cigarettes, and a reduction in indoor smoking all happened in the same time frame as the introduction of flame retardants beginning in the late 1970s. While the chemical industry would like to take credit for reductions in fire deaths, there is strong evidence that that is not where credit is due. Why are firefighters so keen to ban flame retardants? Firefighters experience their colleagues battling and succumbing to cancers that are directly linked to breathing smoke from burning flame retardants. Individual firefighters across the state and the Alaska Fire Chiefs Association have written letters of support for HB 27, which you'll find in your packet. Retired Anchorage firefighter Carol Bacon testified before you last April. She has a rare blood cancer and is one of many Anchorage firefighters who have been diagnosed with cancer. Senator Lisa Murkowski sponsored the Cancer Registry Act in response to the cancer death of Anchorage firefighter Andy Mullen, whose death was linked with exposure to toxins from burning electrical wires. Right here at home, our first responders are getting sick. Last spring, you heard from Dr. Vintanas Babrauskas, a leading global expert on fire protection engineering. His 14-page resume of professional accomplishments and scientific publications was shared and is on BASIS. He summarized, "The plethora of harm and the lack of benefits make conclusions quite obvious. We should not be putting flame retardants into consumer goods that end up in the household and are likely to adversely affect your children." Last spring, the Anchorage Assembly unanimously adopted a municipal ban on flame retardants, which went into effect on January 1st of this year. HB 27 is the ninth flame retardant bill before the Alaska legislature since 2008. The chemical industry launched aggressive and dishonest campaigns in state houses across the country, including Alaska, to stop these bills from being... until being exposed by Chicago Tribune in 2012. A doctor who testified in Alaska before the legislature and in other states lost his license for lying on the record. State legislatures and local governments are taking action over the past decade because the federal government is not. Industry claims that federal rulemaking is in the works and a better solution than a fragmented system of laws. This is true. However, until there is federal rulemaking, which may never, maybe never, you have the opportunity to reduce the harm to Alaskans throughout the state by adopting a law that is quite similar to that of Anchorage's. In Alaska, we spend more time indoors in the winter and are at higher risk for exposure, as are our kids. Alaskan support for passing a flame retardant bill is wide and strong. You'll find letters from the Governor's Council on Disabilities and Special Education, the Cancer Action Network in Alaska, the Alaska School Nurses Association, Scan Home, an Anchorage furniture dealer, the Alaska Children's Trust, the Learning Disabilities Association of Alaska, the Alaska Public Interest Research Group. In 2011 and 12, the supporting letters have included a resolution from Alaska Federation of Natives, the Alaska Nurses Association, the Alaska Mental Health Trust, the Alaska Professional Firefighters Association, the ARC of Anchorage, the Association of Village Council Presidents, and the Alaska Intertribal Council. Alaskans who are in the know that exposure to flame retardants is harmful. A falloff in letters of support is a sign of fatigue with the failures of legislatures to adopt protection session after session. We have the household equivalent of a canary in a coal mine, if only we had been paying attention. House cats. In 1972, feline hyperthyroidism didn't exist. In 1979, the first five cases of feline hyperthyroidism were presented at a veterinary conference in Seattle. By 1980, one in 200 cats was being diagnosed. Various studies of blood levels and contact implicate flame retardants. I'll pause to let you consider what you think the rate is today. None in 1972, one in 200 in 1980. It's estimated that one in 10 cats, house cats, are now afflicted with this that's directly linked to flame retardants. In the interest of respecting your time and because a more substantive version of this bill has been heard twice before the committee, we have not brought expert testimony today. Pam Miller from Alaska Community Action on Toxics is online if there is a technical question that needs to be addressed. There are safe, affordable alternatives that exist to permanent protections from fire, to provide protections from fire while not inadvertently causing a plethora of far-reaching and permanent harms to children, firefighters, and all other Alaskans. You've received letters from industry representatives with specific technical concerns. We have been responsive to those concerns and drafted amendments. I will share them with your offices with the goal of addressing them and moving the bill forward. So if you have this CS before you, I will move through the changes, which I've also provided a printed copy of this to your offices. So the CS makes changes to clarify that the Act includes upholstered furniture used in all homes, not just those with children. It removes any labeling requirement. The labeling requirement was a big sticking point for the industry because our market is so small. And it addresses reupholstered furniture in a manner consistent with the recently passed Anchorage law. So the title changes to the language a little bit, addresses resale, And we've removed the penalty for violation of labeling because there is no labeling requirement anymore. We removed detachable car seats. The industry still expressed concern about car seats, and we realized that it could be because you could have an upholstered car seat that's in your home, and so we have an amendment drafted. We have an amendment to address the industry's concern about car seats if we need to bring that into play. And we aligned our definitions of upholstered and reupholstered furniture with the Anchorage law. So I think
Thank you, Ms. Hart, through
this quickly since you've heard it so much before.
The one other thing I would just add is that the effective date needs to be updated because it reflects if a bill had passed last year, but the intention would be have some lag time for the retailers to respond to the law and have time to implement it. So push it out by 1 year was how it would have been how it was written, and we have an amendment to push it out another year so that there would be time for that. Any questions from committee members? Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Chair Tarr. I will admit that I'm not a huge expert on flame retardants, so I had a few emails from several groups opposing. I feel like last year we didn't have very much opposition, so I felt like it was a pretty safe area. The letter that we received on January 23rd, I believe it was sent to all of the Alaska House Resource Committee members. I forwarded that letter to my father-in-law, who's a battalion chief in Minot, North Dakota. He's been a firefighter for 20 or 25 years now, and I just kind of asked him what his thought was. And he said that based on the letter, it would seem that we should maybe take into consideration some of the research that was referenced in that letter. He did say that fires burn hotter than ever, and with lightweight construction, it's very dangerous. They have less time in and on the structures before it can become too dangerous for them to operate. So I'm super conflicted because I have two very young children, and I guess my concern is if they're in their bedroom at night and a fire starts in our house, do I want them to have the protection of flame retardants, or do I want to risk the potential negative consequences? So that's kind of where I'm at. I would love to hear if there's any rebuttal to those comments that were made by the, it was the Alaska or the American Chemical Group. I just lost my letter. But if there was anything in response to that, I would really appreciate it for clarification.
Thank you, Representative Rasmussen. And I don't know, Ms. Hart, I'll just take a stab, and then if you want to respond to that. And so these, I think, should be online just for anyone who's following along, because there were a handful of industry letters that came in opposition. And if you're referring to the one about the American Chemistry Council,
yeah, thank you.
I guess what I would say in response is there are there have been some changes. So, for example, back in the 70s, we did actually put some of these same chemicals into children's clothing for the same kind of protective factor. But then because we learned about the adverse health impacts, we've since made that illegal. And in response to some of the concerns, so, for example, cigarettes used to be a big way that house fires started. Cigarettes are now self-extinguishing. And so that's one of the modifications that's been made to, you know, eliminate that particular problem. You know, a lot more enforcement, for example, on fire alarms and trying to be, you know, more preventative in nature. One of the challenges with these flame retardants is they, you know, do provide sort of a little buffer, a little delay, if you will. And the idea is that, you know, hopefully that would be enough time that you would be able to be responsive. But it's not a significant, you know, amount of time. So I guess for me on this issue, that's why I've looked to the professionals, and we've had such strong support from the firefighting community, from the Alaska Fire Chiefs Association, that they felt like we should be pushing for removing these chemicals and then pushing for the safer alternatives because of the high risk for health problems and the cancers that they're experiencing. So it's a little bit of a struggle, I think, to weigh those. But one of the things that we always talk about when we're looking at this is just it's sort of like we know what we know today, and as we learn new things, trying to evolve. And I will say over the 20 years I've been working on these issues, we've seen significant improvement in the number of products that are available in response to this. So, for example, now there's more than almost half the country that have passed some kind of legislation with these restrictions. So in response, the retailers and the manufacturers are making the new products. So Alaska doesn't have to kind of be like the first in the queue, if you will, because we're a small retail market. Once California does something, kind of the saying is always the way California goes, so goes the West Coast, because they dominate population-wise, so sort of whatever consumers are buying in California is like what the rest of the West Coast is going to get. So I don't know if that answers those questions, but it is sort of trying to balance those two things. And my hope would just be, again, like that we, one, provide that transition time for retailers so that they can not have like a business loss in terms of the products, but then inspire that new product development so that they're both responsive for fires. Like wool, for example, is naturally flame retardant. Mm-hmm. So if you have wool rugs in your house, right, you're, both providing protection and eliminating the risk from exposures to those other chemicals. Ms. Hart, do you have anything you want to add?
I might just add that I can get to you. It's difficult to share here. I didn't bring, but there are some links that demonstrate the difference in timing in laboratories of the different, and I will get those links to you. And there's also, just in terms of a safety barrier, Representative Tarr shared this last fall, a video that's from a fire test center where they show how having your bedroom doors closed at night can be life-saving. And so there are also some behavioral things that we can do to save or to strengthen the safety without risking. So I'll get your office some links.
Thank you. Quick follow-up. I just wanted to note that as a residential appraiser, I've been alarmed, especially this last year, at how many homes and especially rental properties that I've inspected that do not have any smoke alarms installed. I know that the code is one in every bedroom and then one in any living space. Mm-hmm. It's a staggering number, I would say, of places that don't have. I mean, I think it happens a lot where people get annoyed by the beeping from the batteries being dead and they just take it down. And it's really alarming to me, especially in rentals, that we have people that just don't have smoke detectors. So just bring it to the group to consider while we're thinking about this bill and if there's anything we can do to work on that. I think the fire safety aspect is my biggest concern. So if we can continue to improve that, I would be happy to move forward.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Representative Hannon.
Thank you. Through the chair, last year when we heard the bill, the Anchorage ordinance, we didn't delve into very deeply. So I'm hoping you can explain to me where we align with the Anchorage ordinance that's now in place and where we differ. And in the title, because that was the other piece, is where it's the manufacturer and whether we found any Alaskan-based manufacturing that would be impacted when this goes into place. Is there somebody manufacturing smoke retardant snow machine seat covers and they would go out of, because the Anchorage ordinance, I don't think, touched manufacturing, just distribution and sales. So,
good question. Through the chair, the snow machine wouldn't be covered unless somebody's using it as household furnishing, which is possible in Alaska.
It's likely in Alaska.
But I am not aware of, and we have not been contacted by anyone who is involved in manufacturing who has expressed, we haven't been contacted by anyone who is involved in manufacturing. So I can't speak to that. In terms of the specific changes from the Anchorage Ordinance, this bill does not align perfectly with the Anchorage Ordinance. And part of the reason for that is because neither ordinance has teeth, and neither provides any money for enforcement, but it does encourage and incentivize the industry to work at a national level to get one unified law that would cover all jurisdictions across the country without having to deal with a lot of different laws across the country, which they state that is difficult for them. At the same time, they've mentioned this national law that's in the works, I find back to 2008 at least, and there is still no national law that seems near giving birth anywhere. So not being perfectly aligned is actually part of what makes this help to provide better protections in the future. But on the points, the most critical points that we differ are that we prohibit toys that have flame retardants in them, and Anchorage does not. We prohibit electronics, and Anchorage has taken electronics out. There's electronics in the casing on the computers and on the casings on your speakers and your phone. So we have included those. Anchorage took them out. And the child restraint system, we got a comment from the toy, from one of the industry groups concerned about the way ours was written, if it covered child seats. So we have an amendment drafted that puts us right in line with the Anchorage language that exempts child restraint systems, which are regulated under 49 CFR 571.213.
And I'll just add to that and then do your follow-up question. I think the section that Ms. Hart was referring to on page 3, line 22, participation in the Interstate Chemical Clearinghouse, that's the part that refers to trying to work with other states to develop national policy, because having a consistent national policy would be better, and it'd be, you know, better on the industry in terms of all the manufacturing and stuff. So that's the specific reference in the language for that. And on the other first two points, I think Ms. Hart mentioned that we have amendments drafted, and we just are going to bring those around. But we have amendments drafted, I think, to address like the four different specific concerns brought up, including the electronics and the toys that you just mentioned.
Yes.
And so I think it's more for us as a committee to decide, you know, if we want to be a little more comprehensive to have a couple of those additional items. So there's sort of the core pieces that where we align with Anchorage, and then the Interstate Clearinghouse so that we can participate in national policy development. And then there's a few few other specific instances like the toys and the electronics. And if we want to be totally the same as Anchorage, we can adopt those amendments and you know, start there. But that way we can at least have the conversation about that and just sort of more the educational aspect of it too, of just understanding the widespread use of these different products. Follow-up. Representative Hamm.
Follow-up. Thank you, Madam Chair. So Anchorage's ordinance doesn't cover toys and electronics, but if this were passed in state law, then their distribution, if they include fire retardants, it's moot because it's just broader and more expansive. Did you, and I guess this is the pitch where there is at least one local Juno manufacturer of all wood toys, which are not going to be covered in any plastics or fire retardants. But I don't know of anybody in Alaska manufacturing electronics. And are there concerns in the interstate level of what that does to our very technology-driven economy? Like, is there certain brands of cell phones that are jumping ahead of this and going, this is the curve of the 21st century, as we find cancer clusters and know that your cell phone is causing it not because of gamma rays, but because of the plastic fire retardants included in it? And are there, where's that market share going, and have we looked at what that does if we ban them? But is it a moot point because there is no enforcement nor fiscal note for enforcement?
Do you want to start?
Through the chair, if I might point out, the city of San Francisco has banned electronics. The state of California has not, but the city of San Francisco enacted quite a rigorous ban, which is interesting when you figure that the boundaries between San Francisco and the next jurisdictions are very porous. So if you want to buy something that's banned in San Francisco, you just go 3 miles and buy it. But San Francisco did feel comfortable enough with the situation that they did ban it. And I can get you that information.
And I'll just add to that, going back to that comment of the way California goes, so goes the West Coast. So when we're working on these, I mean, generally, I'm watching what California does, because if they make that change, then we know the sufficient quantity at affordable price of the new product will be available because their population demands it. And so it's, yeah, you know, if we get a little ahead of that, I think that is a valid concern. And so that's why I want to be reasonable to address these industry concerns and you know, everyone on the committee's concerns. And so that may be a piece that we're like a little bit ahead on, and we can reconsider that later. But I think it's just worth us thinking about, you know, which parts we want to lead on and where we can comfortably move at this time based on other, you know, other actions in other places too. Is that done, Representative Hamm?
I'm done.
Okay.
Thank you.
Representative Sponholz.
Thank you. I think this is an interesting conversation that we're having right now about sort of how states impact policy at, you know, at higher levels as well, because we know often states are sort of incubators or test beds for policies that can then move up to the federal level, although our economy, we're so small in many respects in terms of our buying power, that it's difficult for us to influence those things. I'm curious, though, I wanted to talk about the length of time that a flame retardant is supposed to delay, you know, incineration of, for example, you know, beds or couch. Like, are we talking about seconds? Are we talking about minutes? You said you would share some information with us, but can you recall?
Yes, it's through the chair. It's been a little while since I watched the video. I took the summer off of this. but it's in the realm of something like 30 seconds. Mm-hmm. There's a pretty graphic video that demonstrates a chair with flame retardants and a chair without flame retardants and igniting them under laboratory situation. And they go, it's hard to imagine that that would be enough time to really make a difference in getting out of a building. Unfortunately, the foams in all of our upholstered furniture are made from petroleum products. Mm-hmm. So they burn pretty well, and basically what they're doing is trying to put a flame retardant on the barrier to slow that a little bit. But if it's not very much time. I'll get you, and I can get to all of the committee the number on the time they estimate, but it's very short.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
A quick follow-up to that point.
Yes, and then Representative Tuxall, you as well. Representative Rasmussen, I was trying to look it up quickly if I could, and I'm sorry, I'm just not recalling either.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would be curious to the time difference. I don't know if this study is out there or not, but of maybe like a room or a household of items, because I could see it being pretty short with just one piece of furniture, but thinking about a house fire, how many items could be more just igniters if they don't have the flame retardants, I guess, to see kind of what the time difference looks like in those scenarios. I don't know if that's even out there, but if you guys have anything like that, I would appreciate it.
Thank you, through the chair. I'll research that and get it out.
Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The correlation between household pets and thyroid problems, is that actually, I don't know if it's a correlation or is it actually the science behind it? Is it actually a direct link or is that just a correlation?
Through the chair, that is an example because it's simply not ethical, legal, or wanted to do studies on humans. house cats spend a considerable amount of time on the floor and grooming, and so they can collect dust in their fur, and then they're grooming that dust into their system. When this hyperthyroidism started showing up, and I can share the scientific studies with you, but when it started showing up, they didn't have any connection to flame retardants. Flame retardants were quite new on the market. They came in late 70s. 79 was the first when the cases showed up. They didn't have any connection to this, and all sorts of studies of what kind of food and what's being done. And as they looked further, they realized that when they take blood serums, that there's a disproportionate amount of flame retardant in the cats that are developing these hyperthyroidism. And then they attached some more devices that tracked how much dust they were picking up. And so they feel that there's a pretty clear link between that physiological thing for a cat. I think the point is that there are really serious health effects that are showing up more and more often. And as we look at the introduction of flame retardants into our households, and we look at many of these different things, whether it's in people or pets, showing up, there seems to be correlation. Causation isn't always possible because of not being able to isolate and test on. But the correlation is looking very strong in so many different areas that it's strongly suggestive. You've got a shorter lifespan with a cat. You've got this contact. So it's not causation proven, but strong correlation.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any other questions? Okay. So just to announce again, then, we would hope to take action if the committee feels ready on Wednesday. We have drafted four amendments blank at this time to address some of the concerns brought through the letters of opposition. I know Carla's planning to go around to offices and has been over this week to assess, like, level of concern and level of support for the amendments. Maybe the concern has been brought to your attention, but it's not something you feel like we need to amend. So we just want to have that conversation with everyone and be, sort of open to concerns and flexible with the work product that we want to send out of here. So we would ask if anyone else has amendments that they'd like to offer, if those could be turned in by 1 o'clock tomorrow for consideration on Wednesday. And if there are other concerns, of course, want to, make sure people are comfortable before we try to take any action. We did actually get some bills referred today, so that'll help, but we didn't have any bills really before either, so this is one of them we still had in the queue to take action on. Any other comments or questions on House Bill 27? Okay, well, thank you. Ms. Hart is very thorough, and I know she will get back to you on all of the questions. Good job. Thank you so much, Carla.
And Madam Chair, I remove my objection.
Oh, thank you so much. So the committee substitute, which is version S, has been adopted, and we will work from. Okay, our next item is our presentation, and if Rich and Christina want to come forward, please. Will be a familiar faces. Well, both of them are familiar faces for at least some folks because they've worked with us for a number of years now. Actually, gosh, probably going on almost maybe 15 years or so.
14.
So that is great advantage for us because they have watched us through all of our ups and downs and trials and tribulations of trying to figure out our natural resource policy questions. And so we really appreciate you being here today, and thank you. I know you were doing some trainings over these last couple of days, and I know various people have been attending those, so thank you so much for being available to help school all of us on all of this. And I think what we'll do is try to do the questions at the end of each slide as we go through. Is that okay with you?
That's fine.
Okay. And then I'll try to be mindful of the time so that we get through the presentation with today's time available. So.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much.
So for the record, my name is Rich Ruggiero, and I'm with N3 Energy.
And Christina Ruggiero with N3 Energy as well.
So A little bit of introduction. As it was said, LBNA gave us a scope of work to come up and to provide foundational training on petroleum fiscal systems. Now, we got a lot of questions asked of us of, do you have an opinion on this or an opinion on that? If anyone knows me of the 14 years I've been working up here, I am full of opinions. But with respect to what we came up to work on, we came up to work on training. And if there were opinions that we offered, they were not with respect to any bills, pending bills, initiatives or regulations. It was about petroleum fiscal systems and how they work here and around the globe. So we tried to stay within our fairway on that as we went through the training. We did have and presented two courses over the about 5 hours. And that was actually putting about a week's worth of training that we've done for other people into 5 hours, and now we're going to try and cram it down into about 45 minutes to an hour to give you the highlights of what we went through. The good news, I think we notice all but two members of this committee were present for at least one of the sessions, and some of the members that we did not know, we do appreciate that there were lots of good questions asked through that process. So there was an excellent dialogue at all six of the sessions that we offered. Can I ask a... there were, as you would expect prior to delivering training during, there's a lot of questions about fair share and how do we compete and how do we compare and the rest. And through the course of the training, we went through and tried to answer those as we could. And I'm sure today you'll have some of the same questions. And so as we go through the slides, as you said, Madam Chair, we're open to any and all questions that you have as it pertains to the training that we did and the slides that we're presenting. There is only one piece that I'm going to get into today that was not part of the training. And I kind of teased in during the training that I kept saying, and we'll get to the slide, that the majority of the capital in the world is spent with people that have a greater government take than Alaska. And as committee, as legislators, and the rest, you should be asking why. And so I put together a small little example to show you why it's possible that the oil companies are spending their money somewhere other than Alaska or spending it where the take is much higher. The take as it's presented in various articles and presentations, etc., why the money is being spent there and not in somewhere like Alaska.
Thank you. I think Representative Rauscher has a question, and I want to apologize because I know I mispronounced your last name, and so I'm thankful to be reminded Ruggiero, not Ruggiero. Ruggiero, thank you.
Thank you, through the chair. I was just wondering, you made a statement that through the training that we took, you intentionally stayed within your a certain lane. Is there any point at which you're going to step out of that lane?
Representative Rabbit, through the chair, no.
Okay, thank you.
All right.
Okay.
Thank you.
So, on to the training that we did. We held 3 days of training. We had a course that was labeled 101, which is very basic, and then one labeled 102. And we offered the 101 class 4 times and the 102 class twice. And roughly with quite a bit of overlap of the people attending both 1 and 2, but we had plus or minus around 100 people attend each of those different courses, which given you've got 60 legislators and a couple staff each, that's like 100 out of 180 or so. So it was quite significant, the number of people that showed up to the training. And as we did say, it was very lively. They had a lot of good questions, and I believe we had a very good dialogue at that. As we said, we purposely didn't talk about any bills or regulations or get into that. We want to do the training. And as I said, we're going to try and highlight a week's course that we did in 5 hours and summarize it here in an hour. So let's get on with the summary. One of the first things that we did is we talked about the nomenclature or the jargon of the industry. Now, as someone who lived in England for 6 years, I soon realized that my English could get me in trouble because American version of English, the words have very different meanings than the British use of that term. And so I had to be very cautious when I was doing business to make sure, whether I was talking to my American colleagues back home or my British colleagues in London, I understood exactly what that term meant. And in the many times we've come back and forth here and into many of the proceedings that we've watched, there's a lot of assumptions made as to what something is versus what it really means. And so we thought it was important to go over nomenclature. And we did give a reference to an oil-filled glossary that Schlumberger puts together that covers almost any term you'll run into in the oil patch, as well as a lot of financial terms as well that get used. So we first went over that. And one of the key things in that nomenclature, there was actually two. One is you'll often hear people talk about state take, even when it's not a state. That's a common term used by those who practice in the world petroleum fiscal systems to refer to the central government, whatever that is. And in the case of here, it actually is a state. So we have some things like that. And we tried to clear up the difference between a resource and a reserve. Because an awful lot, we have people say, well, we have lots of resources. Yes, you do. But you don't have a lot of reserves. And for reserve, it needs to be discovered. It needs to be commercial, and there needs to have been an approval by a company to go forward with the development and the production of those resources. So we tried to just make sure people understood that distinction as they went forward. Something else that we had noted in our various visits and other discussions, people think that a barrel of oil is the same everywhere, and if it's $60 WTI or $60 ANS West Coast, that all oil is $60 WTI or $60 ANS West Coast. It's not. And we went over the fact that oil is graded across a number of different variables. One of the more common ones was API, and it ranges from a low number of API, which means it's a very heavy, thick crude, to a high API number, and that's like flowing water. And we said it's really important to understand, because if you're going to compare yourself to another regime, you have to understand how far away it is from the marker crude that it's based on and how its quality differs from the quality of the marker crude. Because you can find some locations at a given reference price can be several dollars premium to that marker crude, but a lot of times are many dollars below that marker crude. And so, again, when comparing profitability, you can't use the same oil price in every regime where you go. And the same holds true for natural gas. Now, the biggest difference between gas and oil is oil is priced on more of a global market and natural gas on a regional market. So when you see 60 WTI, you'll see not far off of that in West Coast, not that far different to the Middle East, maybe a bit of a gap to Brent. But when you come to natural gas, it's all priced regionally based on the supply-demand in that market. So when we have $2 market gas in the U.S., they might have $10 gas in Japan and Korea, where they don't produce any. So again, gas regional, oil more global priced, and they're not all created equal, and there's different expenses moving different qualities of gas and crude. And one last thing that really came out of questions we had after the class, and just to remind, all these products are really priced from the market back to the wellhead. It's not that if I want $2 for my gas or I want $50 for my oil, that the market will pay $50 plus the cost. It's really what the market has been set less the cost to get to that market, and that's the value of the product. Quite interesting for me, I entered this business in 1978 out of college, and literally when you looked at known proven reserves around the globe, globally we had less than 20 years of oil. Did my senior paper on oil shale at the surface in western Colorado and like the tar sands in Canada, because we were running out. We presented the graphs of the numbers that showed from 1998 to 2018, we increased global oil reserves by 51%. We roughly produced 600 million barrels. and we added as reserves 1.2 trillion barrels. Now, for Alaska, and what we did in the training, we kept trying to take what we were talking about and bring it back and put it into an Alaska perspective. Again, a few decades ago when I started in the business, you would see reserves in a graph of some sort, and you'd look at U.S. or North America, and a big chunk of that was always Alaska. The U.S., if I believe the numbers I remember correctly, we went from about 85 some odd billion barrels in 1998 to over 200 in 2018. You can't see Alaska as but a thin sliver now in the U.S. And so when you really talk about Alaska, its prominence, and what you may or may not be able to do or demand as a resource owner, your position has changed drastically over the last few decades. And that's just to show that there have been many other places where there's been great activity, and not only with that activity, but discoveries turned into production. Okay. We then talked about the intent of these fiscal systems is really what you're trying to do is to attract investor capital. And there always comes up with, well, who am I competing with for that capital? And that competition can change over time. And we went on and talked a bit about that. But really what you're trying to do is offer through your fiscal system the right level of incentive to attract the capital that you need to meet what your long-term goals or whatever your goals are that you have for your state. And interesting enough, even though we've been at this for over 100 years, you cannot find any practitioner or any book or article to tell you that there's an ideal structure. One doesn't exist. And the reason it really doesn't exist is each government and its needs are different. And if you really start digging into each reservoir and each project and the oil companies themselves, they're all very different. And so what you're trying to do is deal in a world of uniqueness but create something where two very unique parties can come together and make something very positive happen for both. And in the world of the basic fiscal systems, we talked about Alaska being sort of a standard concessionary type with tax and royalty.
We do have a question from Representative Hopkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was at this weekend's presentation, so I have some follow-up questions from there. So thank you. It'd be good to have it here. As we see a lot more aging fields around the world, you said the you had one chart with all the different countries around the world changing their different regimes. Has there been any trend towards a specific type of regime, either the concessionary one, or the hybrid risk one, or the PSV one? The risk service one. Has there been any trend in a certain direction with aging fields we've seen over the past few years?
Representative Hopkins, through the chair, I would go beyond the 2 years. I think what we talked about in the training, the whole existence of what's known as the risk service contract, again, here's part of the changing world in which you're competing, is 30 years ago, there weren't very many strong national oil companies. There were a few. In the last 2 to 3 decades, countries that have national oil companies, they've educated themselves with the help of private companies, as well as put emphasis on educating their people at great universities. They now believe that they're capable of running some of these fields. And so as a number of the fields have aged or hit the end of their life, especially under production sharing contracts, those national oil companies are taking them over and then trying to operate them under a different type of arrangement, which is this risk service contract, where the state retains ownership of the base. And as we talked about, then a contract is put together to incentivize a company to work with the national oil company to try and increase production beyond what people think it's going to be. And that is predominantly in mature areas.
So that is a trend in that direction. Is it outside of the state-owned oil companies that we've seen that trend as well, or is it predominantly within those markets?
Representative Hopkins, through the chair, I'm only aware of it in working with national oil companies.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions at this time? Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Co-Chair Tarr. I apologize for not making it this weekend, but I'm excited to hear about it now. And I'm curious if there was more detailed information on the trend of Alaska's decline, kind of a breakdown in different time periods.
Representative Rasmussen to the chair. I think such a thing can be put together, but we don't have that put together right now to show.
Thank you.
Okay, continuing on to slide number six, we then move into the 102 course. And, you know, we kind of went through what the role of the government is, and that's it's the steward of those mineral resources that it owns in the ground. And it needs to determine, both on a near-term and a long-term basis, how to have those developed for the benefit of its people. We kind of talked about the more durable fiscal systems are those that where we see industry commenting as being more durable are those that respond to what we call the inevitable change in the industry. We talk about, one of my oxymorons in my training is the only constant is change. And, we've shown that slide here before, that anybody stable does not mean everything stops. Stable means being able to move with the change as the change occurs. And I think that's something that's very different in the oil patch, say, versus other industries. We also talk about, we get all sorts of questions, what's my fair share? And Christina and I spent the weekend when we get that question, especially from a legislature, saying, what's your goal? What goal do you want for your fiscal system? And we get some views, some kind of, let's stall and kind of think of what to say. But we also had some people say, that's a good question. And this is reason why we didn't start with saying, here's what Alaska is and what Alaska should do, is it really depends. A lot of questions and debate around the initiative and about how well did 21 work or how bad was ACES or how good is, House Bill 411, or 111, I'm sorry, not 411, 111. And it really comes down to they can only be viewed as being successful or unsuccessful against the goals that they were set up to achieve. And so if you don't have goals listed somewhere, it's the old adage, if you don't know where you're going, any road will take you there. And probably when you get there, you're going, ooh, how did I get here? And now how do I hop on to a different direction? And so one of our recommendations is that as you look to decide what you want to do, if you want to do anything with respect to your petroleum fiscal policy, the first step needs to be to sit down and get some agreement in this committee, in this body, in the other body, as to what are you trying to achieve. And we talked a bit about, and we'll show one slide, on how government's taking a position down a fairly narrow path of what they wanted to achieve actually vastly exceeded their goal in getting there. The other thing that we really pointed out, too, is when you look to the upstream, really outside the United States, all the hydrocarbons in the ground are owned by governments. That's the upstream. When we get to the midstream and downstream, so when we get to the pipelines and the ships and the refineries and the utility companies and the rest, that's predominantly owned by the private sector. The other thing that we pointed out within that is the midstream and downstream generally don't invest until their operation is known. I need a pipeline of this size to go from point A to point B, and I'm going to charge a tariff about this, and when I get enough people to sign a contract, I build a pipeline. Low risk, fairly low reward. Think about this on the upstream. We think we know how many wells we got to drill, but we're not sure. We think the reservoir will deliver this much hydrocarbon, but again, we're not sure. We think the facilities are going to cost this much, but we're not sure. And last, but we're not sure, is we think we know what the fiscal system is, but we're not sure. And so that's why when I see a number of people try and compare the returns that an upstream ought to be allowed to those that they're making in the midstream or the downstream, that's where the oil man in me comes out and says, no way. the upstream takes significantly more risk, deals with significantly more unknowns. And think about that. On some projects, they're making multi-billion dollar commitments when they try and narrow the level of risk, but I've never seen something down to less than plus or minus 10 or 15% when they're putting $1 billion on the table. Unheard of in any other industry. But that is the nature of the upstream oil and gas business. So when you're putting your fiscal system together, you've got to see how do your goals align with the uncertainty of their business and also what their goals are that they need to achieve in order to invest.
Representative Hannon has a question.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Rodillo, I was just a lay public member the last time you were consulting, so I truly appreciated the 101 course before the 102 to try and get up on step. You made a comment then, and you've kind of referenced it now, that when we passed, when the legislature passed SB 21, that we've met our goal, that we've got out of it what we wanted. In the public's perception, I heard it that we were going to get 1 million new barrels a year. And certainly with a declining field, and you showed us some graphs that, you know, the problem is to bring in new oil when you've got a declining field and declining oil, so you're not going to get, you know, it's not a straight equation of you're adding A and B and getting C. It's that we have a decline, and now you're going to add some into it. Could you expand on the comment or reference that we got out of SB 21 and changing that, what we thought we were going to get? Or is it the perfect storm of we passed that to incentivize new fields coming online, but the price per barrel and our ability to get those reserves dropped out economically even further? So we got some new oil in, but it's taking a little longer to bring it in literally to the pipeline, or am I stringing together too many anecdotes and I really am off base and a freshman and go back to reading the press reports?
Representative Hannon, through the chair, it could be my memory, but I thought what I mentioned was the goals of ACES were achieved. At the time ACES was passed, there was a list of five goals that actually both bodies agreed to. And one of those was there was a belief that the big three, Conoco, BP, and Exxon, had too strong of a stranglehold on the slope, and you wanted to incentivize new players and get new oil flowing into the pipeline. Now, with the credits that were put in as part of that, there was extensive drilling, and to my understanding, there were quite a number of discoveries made, and that's what I was commenting, that it met, in that regard, it met that goal. The difficulty is, at the time it came to pay for those incentives is when the price of oil crashed and the amount of revenue coming into the state. So that made it look difficult. The other thing, though, that having been asked that question and in further conversations over the last 3 days, is the time cycle in Alaska, I'm going to say, is at least a decade. And so when people say, well, that wasn't successful because I don't have any new oil yet, it takes time. You know, yes, under certain circumstances, pick your state where they're drilling in the lower 48. Within 60 days of an incentive to do so, there will be a well drilled and a well tied into pipeline and flowing and generating revenue. Here in Alaska, even with the best discovery, the short drilling season, the red tape, permitting, et cetera, you're talking about a decade process. So it's kind of hard in a short time frame to be definitive about whether that was successful or unsuccessful. If your focus is laser focused on the present or this year, last year, next year, everything will look unsuccessful in Alaska. You're never going to have a success. In this business in Alaska, you got to step back and widen that perspective and say, ultimately, did the things happen? But also there's a next step to it. You have exploration, you have discovery, and then you have development into production. Do you have everything in place as a state that now that you've got the exploration discoveries, are you putting everything in place to make sure it goes through development and into production? And that's what we've been talking a lot about.
Thank you.
Well, and I just have to comment, so you'll know that you're, you know, people are listening to you when you're talking, because the bullet point number two has been something we have tried, at least I feel like I've tried over and over and over, because if we look at ACEs, the criticism was what happened when the prices went higher than expected, and the progressivity, you know, people didn't sort of anticipate that. Then with Senate Bill 21, we didn't really look at $40, and we certainly didn't look at $27 oil when we passed Senate Bill 21. So I just want to make note of that a huge takeaway for me as we've been trying to work on this stuff the last few years is that hopefully we can learn from those experiences, and we really need to think about something that doesn't fail under one price circumstance or another, and that, you know, would allow us to have something that's more durable, and we wouldn't have this perennial conversation about whether we need to change our oil tax system or not. I've been unsuccessful so far, year number like five of trying, but maybe it'll happen someday. But if we could take those lessons that we've learned and just have them be lessons learned, no blame on anybody, but that's politics, I suppose. But it's unfortunate, because I think we could craft something better for our state that worked for a longer period of time. So, Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Chair Tarr. When you were referring to the time cycle of a decade, is that time cycle in reference to implementation of a specific policy or a certain point in the exploration process?
Representative Rasmussen, to the chair, if we look at the process of that an oil company goes through, I do a study on an area. I go out and purchase the rights to start exploration in that area, drill a well, have a discovery, put a development plan together, and get it on production. That's the 10-year plus cycle that I'm talking about. You know, all those actions, I can do them boom, 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 boom in the lower 48 a lot. Mm-hmm. Not in the Gulf of Mexico. No, that also has quite an extended, I call it life cycle, to getting from purchasing the acreage to on production. But if I look lower 48 land, you're dealing with months as opposed to years up here.
Quick follow-up. So do you have consideration in that time frame for policy changes that could delay the project out? Is there kind of any scientific information behind that?
Representative Rasmussen, through the chair, I don't know of any scientific information. The only thing that I know is that when you greatly disrupt during that 10-year cycle the fiscal system that they thought they were working under, if you remember earlier in my presentation, I talked about one of the risks was the risk that the financial terms are what we thought they were going to be at the time we made that commitment. That is important, and the more that changes, the greater that risk becomes to people looking to do business.
Thank you.
Okay.
All right, please continue.
Move on to slide 7. I'm going to have to speed it up here. The other thing that we talked about, and we just see so often, and I personally cringe, and my daughter tries to hold me back from shouting at TVs and things like that. But when people go up and say, and they can put a single metric up and draw a line and say you're competitive or you're not competitive, that's just not true. That is, there's no way you can compare two regimes by using a single metric, even if that metric is the overall government take. And that's where my little example I put together, I'm going to show you why. And why, if that's the case, so much money is spent in regimes with high government take. The other thing, which we'll show a few of these, but whether it's concession or contract, there are a lot of different tools that get used in those contracts. And of those tools, there are multiple ways in which the tool can be used, creating hundreds, if not thousands, of variations on how you can put together a petroleum fiscal system, which is probably why there's no one single ideal system that anybody uses. The other important thing that I tried to get across, though, in looking at the different structures, is whether you're in a licensing, tax and royalty to start, or production sharing contract, with these various tools, economically, I can make any one of them look like any one of the other ones within modeling reason, extremely close. So then what you get to is you choose the structure that you're using for different reasons or different purposes. And this is where the concession agreements tend to be, where they believe the overall central government is more stable and that there is a proper judicial system and precedent in place that if there's a dispute, they can get that resolved and any judgment carried out. And you tend to see them more non-OECD countries using production sharing contracts where they enshrine basically the law within the contract and have that guide how things are done. The last thing on this slide that we went into, which seemed to be a bit eye-opening for a lot of people, is the oil companies don't use our analysis and they don't use DOR's analysis to go back to their management and say, hey, look, here's how much money we can make here. They do their own analysis, and there's a number of things that they put in their analysis that don't go into the Alaska analysis. For example, and we talked about this, there are quite a number of costs that are not allowed. Well, I can tell you, now my time's dated, but I was a major project manager within a big oil company. And when I took a project forward, as I told the people in the class, I never once took that project forward to my board and said, here's how it would have played out in Alaska. And I never said, well, here's what their tax regime allows or not allow. I would present my economics, and my economics would include each and every dollar I expected to spend or have to spend, and each dollar revenue that would be coming in, when it came in, and how it came in. And any reference to the location or the fiscal system would only be to assessing that risk factor on how well did I think the system would stay in place through the life of the project. Because you're generally talking on big projects, 5 to 10 years to get them in place, and anywhere from 20 to 50 years of production life. That's the old conventional. Unconventional has turned that upside down.
I want to recognize Senator Bishop has joined us. Thank you.
Thank you. And this is my last, and every now and then I use a cartoon just to make people remember. We talk about the flaw of averages. Again, when regimes are compared, they tend to always be compared at an average. And I can sit here and tell you, in some regimes, things are as different as 0 and 10. But if I average that, it's a 5, so it'll be presented as a 5. In another regime, things will be tightly distributed like 4 to 6. That also is an average of 5. But those two different sets of fiscal systems could not be more different. But sometimes, the way things get averaged out, it misrepresents exactly what you can do in that regime and what's possible. And also, I know by reasons of taxpayer confidentiality, a lot of the numbers you see, especially in the resource book, are averages. And the only thing that I can say with certainty is there's not a single field that matches those averages. Mm-hmm. Now, that was a highlight of the 5 hours. But I'm going to dig into a couple more areas. And you know, we get into this one right here. We've talked about it a little bit before, is that the only change is constant. And where fiscal systems and governments get themselves in trouble is when they try and say, at this price, I've got this profit level. And they design their system around it. The only thing that we know for sure is it might be a month, it might be a year, but that will no longer be valid. And if it ever is valid again, it's only by chance. And so when you set up a system based on a lot of hard points nailed into the ground, stakes in the ground at a certain point, the one thing you know is that you get further out in time, you're probably further from what you intended that to achieve. And I used the example in the class when the current gross tax system was set up. I believe it's zero up to $5. Why, at that point in time, $5 was the cost that was being shown. Why tax when they're not making a profit? So we start at 1% when they're making a profit. Well, today, as we know, the cost structure is well beyond $5, but you still have the 0, 1, 2, 3, 4 at the price points that you have them. So the intent on how those were derived, et cetera, is gone. And we'll, I believe we'll never see it again, cost structures down to $5. So that's just an example of when you do things on a fixed basis, but the world changes. Systems that are somehow set up to move with those changes, a bit more durable. Those that don't move are the ones that generally put a lot of tension in the system and tension for change.
Representative Hopkins.
Thank you. I'm trying to figure out what would qualify and what a more durable system would look like. Are there tax regimes out there that are not as price dependent as ours, something maybe more along production dependence or benchmarks or anything that are achieved? What are some of the other avenues besides just basing it off either price of a barrel or price of inputs and outputs of costs?
Representative Hopkins through the chair. Probably the most responsive are those that use any one of about 5 or 6 different methodologies for determining levels of profitability. And generally in those systems, when profitability is non-existent or low, the government take is low. And as that moves up to where profitability gets higher, then the government share gets much, much higher.
So like progressivity when we had ACEs, but not to the same extent?
Representative Hopkins, to the chair, I'm going to say progressivity tended to change because it imputed at higher net barrel to cost or price of barrel to the cost went up, it would take more. But that's very different than saying net profitability. And so I think that's a little bit where the disconnect comes in with the industry with ACEs. It wasn't a representation of profitability. It was just representation of margin on a barrel that day or that month.
Okay.
Representative Rasmussen and Hannon.
Thank you, Co-Chair Tarr. So I guess one of my questions when it comes to policy is, are there any other states or countries who have been able, sorry, going back to the 10-year thing again, are there any other governments that have kept a 10-year policy in place for a full decade without making any changes or any substantial changes, I guess I should say?
Representative Rasmussen through the chair. This is where we have to break down contract-type regimes into license regimes. Under the contract regimes, they generally don't change for the life of the contract unless two parties want it to change. And only then if operations under that, where the economics get so dissimilar to what they were at the time it was approved, they generally don't change. But if it's much different, the parties will get together and change. Under licensing, you see different philosophies on change. Now, the one example I always use is there was always an industry survey that was done of senior leaders of oil companies on what was the most stable environment to work in from a fiscal stability standpoint. And for over 20 years, ranked in the top 3 was the United Kingdom. During that same period, which country changed its fiscal system more than any other? The United Kingdom. The difference being is when prices went down, they relaxed their taxes, they took away royalty, they did a number of things to keep the oil and the gas flowing when prices were low. Then as prices went back up, they would increase the government share of what was going on. And they've done this multiple times through the cycle. So stable can also mean changing, but changing in tune with the profitability of the industry at the time.
Good follow-up. Mm-hmm. Would you say that under the current SB 21 that we have a system that is kind of designed to do that, to keep production relatively stable?
Representative Restman, the chair, I don't think it was designed to keep production stable. I think it was designed to incentivize some investment in order to change production. And now, stable can be growth because old fields decline and are constantly declining. So if I levelize production, that is actually a growth in production. But, you know, the goals and things that were there, again, you have to go back when that was all put together. Unfortunately, we have a window when we were absent, and it was SB 21.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
Well, and just as a comment, when we were working on this under the current conditions and the way the equation works, you know, where we have wellhead price minus transportation minus operating minus capital and then get to the PTV, the production tax value, you had suggested before that might be a more appropriate place to tax because that would be a reflection of profitability because in a net profit system, all expenses at that point have been accounted for.
Representative Charles, through the chair, I believe that's what we talked about.
So we've talked about that a little bit in committee, and that, I don't know if that was helpful. But, again, one of my takeaways from your previous training, I am using it. Representative Hannon.
Thank you. Through the chair, hopefully I'm using that learning now. So I want to go back to Representative Hopkins and Chair Tarr actually segued. But when we're measuring profitability, and every fiscal regime could be different, but how widely for that policy to be good is profitability measured? That barrel on that development, that ring fence development, that North Slope development, that state of Alaska, their worldwide investment. So when we're measuring profitability and setting policy of having some progressivity in our tax base, measuring is that barrel profitable and our tax rate changes, do you have a standard recommendation of where you measure that profitability for a company? Or is it the whole spectrum of worldwide investment and this barrel today might have lost in the new field, but you're still very profitable in your worldwide investments?
Representative Hand through the chair. You've kind of asked a question for me to do it. Pure justice would be a two-hour answer. But I'm glad one of the things I hear coming back from the training is it depends on what the ring fence is. So what type of system you put in place depends on what ring fence you have. And so is it a project ring fence, a project profitability? It's never that the profitability metrics and tools that I've talked about are usually used over the life of a project, not per barrel. Because a per barrel, again, is one of those point in time and is not really indicative of the whole. And when you have projects that take decades to go from beginning to end, a single barrel isn't indicative of much but that single barrel.
Follow up.
And with that, could I extrapolate that not with regard to what that company is doing in any other location, but just that project's profitability standalone versus I've got five projects in Alaska and five in East Timor?
Representative Hand through the chair. Normally, a fiscal regime does not look outside itself. So in this case of Alaska, you would not be looking at anything outside of Alaska. That said, it is then your choice, you know, do you want to separate the North Slope from everything else? Do you want to separate new projects from old projects? The list goes on and on. You have multiple options of what type of separation or ring fence you want to use. And I hate to say this, but what system you use goes in line with what ring fence you use. So you can make it what you want, but you can't go outside your regime.
Thank you. Okay, please continue.
The next slide, number 11, again, not going to go over this, but people said, well, who do I compete with? I always hear that when I come out there. Which regime do I compete with, and how do I do this analysis? And this is the problem that we have. So you've got a graph up here that goes from 2001 to 2016. These are all the countries that changed their fiscal regime, and some countries are up there multiple times in that time frame. And so when you're trying, when somebody comes up and does you a comparison to Norway or a comparison to Argentina or pick a place, which one of those dots up there are they comparing to? And when did they do their analysis and what was the regime in place when they did it? And is that still the regime that's in place when they're making a recommendation to you off of that? Or have they already changed? Again, this is just not to go over in detail, not to read anything into it, other than look to see where there's orange when things are going down versus orange when things are going up. Orange is when government take increases. And when you have a lot of orange where the price is going down, that's actually the government going in the opposite direction to where the industry is going, is they're trying to take more when there's less to take.
Well, it's just interesting. I mean, it clearly follows the price line, right? Like the orange increases are all as the price was going up there. I did want to ask if Alaska is on here, and I'm struggling.
Alaska's on there in a couple places.
Okay, I didn't see him. Okay, there we are. Okay.
Yeah, you can see Alaska's like go above 06, January 06, and it's the third one up. It goes Oman, Libya, Alaska. Mm-hmm. And then again for ACES, you go near the peak of the oil price there around 140. It's just to the left of China.
Oh, there
China.
We go. Okay, I see us. Okay, yeah.
So there's, and then another Alaska for SB 21 in 2013. It sits just under the price curve, about two dots boxes under the price curve. So Alaska's up there three times.
Do you know on these if anyone else is similarly situated so that they've been so reliant on the revenue from you know, their oil and gas policies where, you know, for us for so long it's been, you know, upwards of 90% with our royalties of our revenue on an annual basis. And I just wonder if that's one of the things that we should observe in this, because it would be easier to be more nimble with our oil and gas tax policy if we were not, like, it seems, you know, if we weren't so heavily reliant on that, if it was, you know, a smaller piece of the pie. And I'm just wondering if that might be one of the dynamics when you study these other places that allows them to, you know, be a little more responsive.
Representative Tarr, through the chair, kind of the question you ask, you can ask from a number of different perspectives as well. For example, let me go to the UK because I've used that example. I was in the UK from 90 through 96.
Okay.
And within my area of remit included two of the terminals, shore terminals, where the offshore production came into the country. The equivalent of the Department of Defense ran the perimeter on my shore terminals. That was so important to the manufacturing machine of the UK that it was imperative that that energy make it to shore and then it make it to the factories and the rest. And it had great government importance. So when production starts to fall off, they also had a goal as a country not to be too dependent on imports. So thus, their measures, they dropped royalty, they greatly dropped taxes because it was extremely important for them to get domestic supply coming in. And so a lot of these changes that you see, it wasn't, they had different driver. Okay. Although they're operating in the same world with the same pricing with the same oil companies, mm-hmm. they've got a very different driver.
And Madam Chair, if I may, another thing to note that we talked about in the training on this slide is that each of these boxes tells a story. And so if you look into the situation in each one of these, there's a reason that they made this change, and it might have something to do with, yes, it's a large part of revenue for their jurisdiction. It might be that they're trying to incentivize exploration. It might be they're trying to incentivize production. It might be that they've said, okay, we're going to open to foreign investment. It might be that they had contracts that came in 20, 30 years ago that are now towards the end and they've decided to make a change. So maybe they're not extending these contracts. They've decided to come with a new generation of contracts, and that's going to cause this shift. Mm-hmm. And so in training, when we talked about how do we compare, how are we competitive, what's common around the globe, we really dug into some factors and said each one of these is a story. Mm-hmm. And that's why we look to say, what are your goals? What are your drivers? Because that will drive why you're making a change and what direction you're making it and what does that change look like, or what does that fiscal policy look like? So it's difficult to run these comparisons. It's difficult to look at the headline tax rate because there is a story, and you can't see that story in a 60% or a 45% or a 90%. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yes.
Any other questions? Okay.
Any more questions? Okay, we'll move on to slide 12. Again, this is just a continuation of saying about being flexible in the design of your system. But something else we talked about in the training, and I really began to learn from Shell at the time, is when I was doing strategic planning, Shell would use scenario planning, and they had five defined scenarios that fit Shell's business on things like oil price crash, oil price going up forever, going green, world conflict, and they would actually test their strategy against each of those end-state scenarios. They didn't pick one. And a lot of times when governments look to fiscal policy, they seem to zero in on one future and put a policy to that one future without really testing it to say, not that you wouldn't have to do some tweakings, but how resilient is that fiscal policy if one of these other end states should happen? So really what we talked about, as you look to do any change, or if you're brand new putting new fiscal policy in place, what are the goals you want to achieve? Look at it across some agreed end states, and then therefore you know when you finally put something down in print and vote on it and approve it, it's got some resiliency. And when things happen in the future, Madam Chair, as you said before, oh, we didn't expect 140 oil, oh, we didn't expect $40 oil. You will have done that in your analysis to say, mm-hmm. does this work at 140? How? Does this work at 40? How? Mm-hmm. And can it sustain the same 60 forever? You know, so you have to look at these different, some different future scenarios against a set of goals and then decide what to do with your petroleum policy. We just wanted to show this as one example. Is after the big price drop of the early 80s, development activity and whatnot really fell off in Latin and South America. And it got to be the reserves were declining greatly. So what you see on the graph on the right is plotting eight different regions of the globe, and it plots what we call the R to P, or reserves to production ratio. So what that takes is the reserves in that area divided by the annual production in that area. So you can see that dark green in 1988 started somewhere around 45, but then you see the big uptick that comes right around 08 and then continuing. Almost in unison, a number of the Latin American countries changed their fiscal systems to incentivize exploration and development. Personally, Christina was working South America at that time in our operations department at Baker Hughes. I was working project development in Baker Hughes, and we had a great focus ourselves as a service company in that region based on the activity, and the activity was being driven by some very unique and creative things the different governments were doing to attract interest. Now, having to find huge deposits like the pre-salt in Brazil and a number of offshore finds in Ecuador, et cetera, that kept the enthusiasm up. But that's an example where several countries said, we want to incentivize exploration. And because the time window is a bit shorter, they were able to actually turn that exploration into actual development and production and reserves. And that was the whole reason for showing this curve. And again, we put a lot of plots into the training where you can look at this for gas, you look at it for oil, and you can go to the BP statistical review, which is just excellent for data on the industry. And you can see these trends over different time periods and break down the different areas to see which countries did what. But this, to me, is just the result of an area achieving what the goals were for its fiscal policies. Now I want to go through, next on slide 15, we always talk about this. There's a couple things that come up relative to Alaska that I've heard a lot being here. First was a debate over NOLs and being a giveaway to the industry. NOLs are just businesses recovering their costs. And I used in the training course an example. There are two banks. One bank, you put in $100, and in a period of time in the future, you withdraw $150. You're going to pay tax on the $50 because that's your interest or your gain. But Bank B, when you put your $100 in, every year you don't withdraw it, they take away part of your investment, but they still give you 150 in the end, but now you have to pay tax on the whole 50. You're paying tax on the money you put in. So which bank are you going to do business with? Everybody's going to do business with Bank A. nobody wants to have to pay tax on the money that they put in. They only want to pay tax on the money that they earn. So when you take away NOLs from the industry, you're basically saying if they ultimately do a development, you're telling them they have to pay tax on their own investment money. So that was the first thing that we want to talk about. The second one was cost being allowed or not being allowed. And different regimes handle this very differently as to what costs they allow or not. Two costs that are often not allowed to be deducted are excessive overhead and financing and any environmental type penalties. But other than that, most costs are allowed to be deducted and recovered without paying tax on those. So this is an example of the standard type of representation you'll see from experts in the industry. The chart on the left on slide 16 is a list of countries from top to bottom. The lower government take is to the right. The higher government take is to the left. So we start with Ireland at about 18% at the top, and we end up down with Iran and Venezuela around 90% take on the bottom. Alaska appears right about in the middle on this one. A couple years ago, when I did analysis, there was significant spending in countries below Alaska. I mean, we know we can see this development in places like Malaysia and Indonesia. I talked about Ecuador. Angola, we know, is booming with investment. Norway continues to have significant investment. These are all areas that have higher take than Alaska. So what that tells me, and I may be wrong and not that much of a genius, but there's something other than the government take that decides where people invest. And so we have to dig a little bit deeper, and that's what we went into in the class, is that all the other things that come into play. So I kept getting this question of why. So this was not in the training, so this is the add-on for today. I took a simple example, and all I'm doing is playing with tax rates, disallowed cost, and uplift. So the tax rate, this has to do with, do you have a gross tax like royalty, net tax on profits? Disallowed cost, meaning which cost the oil company actually experiences and has to pay, but doesn't get to deduct or recover. So in a way, the revenue associated with that gets taxed, even though they're cost. Yeah. And then, as I said, uplift is giving interest on their unrecovered cost to account for the time value of money. Because as we said, sometimes significant amounts are invested 5 to 10 years before they're within a ring fence before they're ever recovered. So generally, the tighter the ring fence around where I can get revenue to recover my cost, the more likely it is there may be some form of uplift associated to compensate for the time value. So what we have here are three regimes. The fact that they may bear resemblance to Alaska, Norway, and someplace in the Far East is just happenstance. But you'll see we've listed out allowable costs, disallowed costs. So the total cost in all three of these is 115. Happens in regime A that disallowed are 25. Regime C gives a 10% uplift. Regime A has a 15% royalty, and then other than that, the net tax in A is 45%, B is 75%, and regime C is 85%. And you'd say, clearly, at plus or minus just shy of 60% government take, A is going to be better than B or C. But we know it's not quite. So a real estimate, and not done, but just for rounding purposes, I put how this would be plotted like government take on that plot. Regime A would be 60, B 75, C 85. So let's say they generate 200 revenue, and I'll walk down through regime A. At 15% royalty, we subtract 30 for the royalty, 90 allowed costs, that gives me a taxable income of 80. At 45% tax, that's 36 for the tax, they now have a gross profit of 44. But when they do their economics, they have to account for that other 25 of disallowed cost. And in the end, their share out of that project was 19. So let's go to regime B. Same 200 revenue, but all the costs are allowed, the 115. Gives a taxable income of 85. Now the net tax is higher at 64. They have a gross profit of 21, but they got to deduct all of their costs, so they have no further cost to deduct when they do their internal economics. So that comes out 21 versus A at 19. But it gets even better. If we go to the regime with the 85% government take, and that's how it would be plotted, that allows uplift. So I take the 200. I have the 115 in cost, but I said I have uplift over 3 years at 10%. They get to deduct another 38 before determining what their taxable income is. So their taxable income is only 47. So even though the tax rate's 85 and their tax is 40 on that 47, they end up with that 7, but they also end up in their pocket that 38 of uplift for a total of 45. So in this example, the country with the highest government take actually has the highest producer profit. Now, I know I'm going to get all sorts of feedback that this is overly simplistic, and I fudge this a little bit of that. But I can tell you that if I'm doing a 20 or 30-year cash flow profile on a real project with these type of numbers of royalty, tax rate, uplift, allowed and disallowed, you would get similar differences in the return to the producer.
And I guess I was just going to add on this uplift idea, because it's not currently in our tax system, but when we did House Bill 111 and there was the earlier slide about the NOLs, the net operating losses, we contemplated adding uplift to that. And so the way our current statute is it can be carried forward for up to 7 years, but we instead use the time allowing it to go up to 7 years, I think, rather than the uplift, and sort of like tried to balance those opportunities out. And then I think the way it is now, and I'm looking at Ken, is I think after if you haven't recovered all the costs after the seventh year, then it's a depreciation from that point forward by 10% annually. So there's all these sort of, we like went to a time certain and then did that. We did a depreciation rather than an earlier uplift. Mm-hmm. But I guess it goes back to the whole time value of money question.
Madam Chair, actually you have negative uplift, because you reduce, so you actually create that banking example that as time goes on, you take away their deduction of the cost they actually spent, and you start taxing them. If they ultimately get to revenue, you'll be taxing them on their investment, parts of their investment. So you go the opposite direction.
I shouldn't call it depreciation, negative uplift, yes. Representative Hannon.
Thank you. Through the chair, I know your examples weren't specific, but there was an illusion that perhaps our current regime does not give all the net operating losses that other regimes do. Could you give me some examples of net operating losses that we don't allow that other regimes do?
Representative Hannah, just if I can apologize, but I'm going to correct the question.
Please.
What I mentioned that there are costs that are incurred that are not allowed to be deducted through the fiscal system. It wasn't just specific to NOLs.
Okay.
So, and this varies from regime to regime.
But I'm, if I, yes, so within that, are there things when you've looked, because you're clearly more familiar with Alaska's petroleum policy in detail than I am, could you give me some examples within ours that might have stood out to you as an outside observer and going, hey, in other places, this is allowed, but Alaska doesn't?
Representative Hand, through the chair, one large one is handling abandonment at end of field life. And many regimes around the world start creating abandonment banks or abandonment funds and put money into it when there's revenues high, so that way the money exists at the end. If you've got a regime where it's non-deductible, you may have billions of dollars of abandonment costs with nothing to write them off against.
Thank you.
Any other questions? I did want to just announce that we have a little bit of extra time in the room. I anticipate we'll need a few extra minutes to get through the slide deck. I think there's 34 slides total. So we're going to shoot for being done by 3:15, because I know some energy committee folks then have committee at 3:30. So we'll continue on.
I will try and speed up, Madam Chair. Okay. So we're on slide 19. What we're really talking about is that we start off simple with fiscal regimes in that we've got revenue minus cost equals profit. How hard can it be to determine revenues, cost, and split the profit? But this is where there's the whole science around what we do here. And I didn't put it on the slide, but for me, the whole process of fiscal regime design is half science, half art. And the half art comes in what are you trying to accomplish, and then what sequence of tools and other things that I can put in place that achieves what you're looking for as goals as a state, but at the same time attracting capital to do the development so you can achieve those goals. I'm not going to go through all these, but you deploy, to some extent, bid fees. What I'm going to put is a number of these pieces that go into fiscal regimes around the world also don't appear in that most common ranking of government take. So, for example, the 8 and 9 figure bonuses on Gulf of Mexico leases do not figure into where Daniel Johnson plotted Gulf of Mexico on his chart. The near billion and billion dollar bonuses paid for some of the Angola blocks don't get plotted in the Angola number on that block. And then when you go start comparing to Mexico and, you know, Texas, et cetera, the old leases that were signed in the 30s and 40s that are still existing today that pay 1/8 royalty is usually what gets used, but the fact that new leases are going out for 20, 25 royalty, not necessarily. So there's a different way in which a lot of these things get treated. I got ahead of myself. The buying the land, a lot of that land was purchased for like $5 an acre. During the rush here recently, we've worked on projects where the right to drill is being purchased at $2,500 to $25,000 an acre. And sometimes a individual shale well can be burdened with up to $4 million of acquisition costs just for the right to drill even before they drill. And then you've got the drilling cost, et cetera, to be recovered from the revenue. So there's a lot of these things that do not figure into that metric when it gets plotted on one of those charts. We've listed various ways in which governments generate income down the rest of the far left-hand column. When you get to the duties, actually in some countries the excise and import duties can be quite large. So whether they're included or excluded, i.e. whether the government waives them or not, can be quite significant on the economics. Going down the middle column, we've got royalty, and then we've got profit. And this is where I said there are many different ways in which profit is split. And each of these try and, in one way or another, represent the profitability of the project as a whole, not the profit on a barrel for that day, that month, or that year. We talked about abandonment bank. On the far right are some things that I won't go into the detail here because of time, but I went through several examples in the training where countries have benefited greatly by very specific and targeted investment by the oil companies in their country or in their locale. I did talk about in Trinidad with the LNG project, you know, my local content was the food vendors for train one, and now it's advanced through welding and whatever schools, and now they're building platforms. So countries can benefit different ways. That value to a country, does it show up in that? No, never shows up in that curve as plotting out as part of the government take. So these are all mechanisms that are in use many times around the world. And as you saw, a lot of them don't figure into that government take.
Well, and I was just going to say on that slide before you go, one for us that would be good to study is, for example, data transfer, because we used incentives in our oil and gas tax system, right? And then one of the things that we had built into it was after a certain number of years, then we get certain data back, and now the state is able to sell that, and there's, you know, revenue generated from the state. So it would be an interesting thing for us to sort of explore you know, in terms of how that worked for us, what did we intend? Ask those same questions. And I think even on our incentives, you know, we should really have that same question and set goal setting exercise that you talked about from ACES, because as you mentioned, one of the ideas was we wanted to get smaller companies and independents, right? That was a goal and why we had to create some incentives. But when we have made these changes, we didn't say as a policy directive that there was no longer a goal to get those smaller companies. We were just financially pressured into making those changes because we couldn't afford the credits anymore. But the goal of attracting new companies never went away. So we really do need to be asking these questions about what these different elements are supposed to be doing, because everything we've done really has been out of sync. Like, we haven't had any goal setting. We've just had to, we're broke, we can't afford it, we have to make changes kind of thing. And I think, you know, for our long-term stability in the oil and gas sector, that may not produce the results that we want.
Yeah, the old adage, you kind of forget your goal is to drain the swamp when you're up to your in alligators.
Mm-hmm. Representative Hannon.
Thank you. Through the chair, I tried to learn all the terms as you presented them, and I even went to that dang Schlumberger glossary after the fact. And I am sure this is because Delta Western is a big oil and gas distributor in Alaska, but Delta Oil and Gas, as used as a term in the industry, remind me, is that the on the Y and the X axis, is that where profitability, or what does the term Delta Oil Gas mean?
Representative Hannon, through the chair, I'm sorry for that confusion, in that is Delta means different for oil and different for gas. Most regimes have a combination of oil and gas together. And yeah, I'm sorry, that was really shorthand only for those of us that have been doing this for a while. You probably didn't find that in the dictionary. Yeah, good catch. On slide 21, when we start really looking at the far left-hand corner, this is the capital expense. This is more so than the operating, but if there is, if you say, well, if really the tax rate and the government take isn't what really drives things, and if, you know, I was asked several times, what would you pick as sort of the top item that drives companies to invest? And for me, it's time. The sooner I can get my costs back, the better my economics look, and the less risk that the project carries with it when it's looking to be approved. And so time plays a greater, an equal if not greater role than the rate of take, i.e. the government rate of take, the tax rate, the royalty, etc. And when it comes to capital expense recovery, that's, I mean, the number of tools that are available, the number of different ways that you can do it is an exhaustive list. And so there's a lot to play with in there with respect to what you may want or not put into your system. Something else that at the time I was there, and again, I don't want to put words in the mouth of the people behind me, but also very important in getting approval when I took projects forward were liability, environmental insurance. It's real interesting that how sometimes these items are emotive, i.e. they carry a bigger emotional value than they do monetary value. Other times they can carry a monetary risk that far exceeds what someone's willing to take. I can tell you that in some countries it goes so far on liability that some governments take full liability of whatever happens unless there's pure gross negligence or willful misconduct. An example is we did the contracts in Iraq, and the Iraq government indemnified the companies for landmines. So you got to think about post-war, the first place I ever had to deal with writing a contract or be part of writing a contract and having to deal with the removal of ordinances that were buried and get clearing permits, et cetera. I mean, so things can get really interesting around the globe. And when we say each government's unique, yeah, working in Iraq, regardless of the experience I had, I ran into more new things in Iraq than I ran into anywhere else in putting together a fiscal package.
Representative Sponholz has a question.
Thank you, Chair Tart. So the time issue, I think, was my biggest takeaway out of the 102 presentation this weekend, that, you know, talking about the timing of when the government take is. And so you've referenced a little bit sort of NOLs, but do you have any, could you give us a couple of other examples of things that we might be able to do which would sort of help encourage, help companies successfully recover their investment early on without, you know, without changing the total government take in the process?
Representative Sponholz, through the chair, I don't have it in here, but if you remember, we did have that one example of the same project under four different regimes, and in one it was highly profitable, and in another it would never see the light of day.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the same cash to the contractor or the oil company and the same amount of cash to the government. So the government take overall was the same, but depending on when you take that money, you can have a highly profitable project from the perspective of the oil companies to one that they it would be a career limiting move to take it in for approval.
Just to sort of underscore the question, what are the specific levers that affect that you could use to sort of in speed up the recovery of front-end investment?
Representative Sponholz to the chair, like one of the first ones we talked about in the training was the fact that in Alaska you can write off capital charges.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as you have the revenue to write those off.
Mm-hmm.
Many regimes use a form of depreciation to recover those over 3 to 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
So Alaska is, you know, in the top 10% of regimes that allow that to be immediately written off. But now if you come in and you start putting ring fences that isolate, another way to incentivize is that I allow monies to move across project boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
So a new project can be written off against an existing project. That has a significant time enhancement element to it. But if you now ring fence it off, make it stand alone, I'm Alaska with a 10-year horizon, and starting in year 7, I'm using negative uplift, that doesn't become very encouraging. That becomes very discouraging to doing investment.
Mm-hmm.
So the things that you can deal with is the period of recovery, how much you're allowed to recover each year. You know, we talked about some regimes cap, although you can recover it immediately, they cap how much each year. So there's at least some money flowing to the profit pool and into the government.
Mm-hmm.
There's many variations, but it really is getting it, the ability to write it off as soon as possible. Or if I can't write it off as soon as possible, providing some form of uplift to keep them whole with the time value of money.
Thank you.
Representative Lincoln.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question related to that, and I think you've done a really good job, I think, this week in helping people to think through some of these issues from the industry perspective and some of their decision making. And going back to the three regimes you described on slide 18, I'm just wondering if you've modeled out like cash flows and NPV for the government side, because I figure like 85% government take, I think that's basically a tax, or what do you mean by the like a regime, the government take being 85%?
Representative, through the chair, when you see those plots about government take, that what they're really saying is if I take the total profit that project has, 85% of it would go to the government.
Over what time frame?
The life of the project.
Okay.
Now, some people say life of the project. Others are really putting onto the chart a marginal dollar. That is, after I've recovered my cost and I have one more dollar of revenue, how is that split? Because as we went through in the class, if I've recently come off another project we worked on for a long time, under that regime, the split on the profits started at 80% to the oil company, 20% to the government, and as they advanced through certain levels of profitability, it ended up at 90% the government, 10% to the oil company. Now, over the life of it, it ends up being some 68% to the government, but that got plotted on the charts as a 90% government take because that was the high end. That was that last dollar into the project. So, again, one of the things we talked about in the training, ask questions. When you're given a comparison, you're given a report, make sure you understand what that number represents, because there are government take charts that are essentially for the same time frame that plot different numbers for the same country. Why? And those are some of the things you need to ask when somebody gives you that comparison.
So just to be clear, so the 85% is total cash, not adjusted for time or anything. All the figures are
representing through the chair. That's correct. That is a just a straight cash flow split.
Okay, we might have to
speed up.
Scoot along just a little.
The last thing, you know, oil company decision bank. We also talked a little about that in the training, because they don't, as I said, they don't look at the economic runs we do. They don't look at the economic runs the DOR does. They have to do their own internal runs. And as much as the time you spend, et cetera, on a multi-year forecast for DOR, companies, especially the larger the company, tend to publish a set of standards that have to be used for every project. If not, as a company, they'd have no way of comparing projects and deciding where's the best place to invest. So they can have different price forecasts, cost forecasts, inflationary forecasts, et cetera, very different than what DOR is using, very different than what we're using. That's what they have to use in order to get their projects approved. You know, there's overhead allocation, everything. But we just spent a little time showing the different things, because when you're trying to say what's my fair share, it's also what am I leaving the producer with, and is that enough for him to actually go in and get approval to do the project? We showed the typical hockey stick that comes with every project on slide 23. And generally, the hockey stick represents the cumulative cash position. So when I'm investing without any revenue, my cash is going negative. It's like spending out of a checking account that I don't have the money. It's very negative. Once the revenue starts coming in, then it starts increasing until it crosses the zero point and becomes positive. Now, that year where the hockey stick, the point is at the bottom of the hockey stick, is where we call positive cash flow begins for the period. Now, in times here, I've heard people say, look at how much profit they're making, because here's how much money they're taking that year. That's actually not profit yet. They are in a cost recovery mode. And so what we really have to look at is when a positive cash flow occurs, it can be before payout or payback. And that's defined as the point in time when their cash in equals their cash out. So is it before that, or is it after that? And there's really three points that we talked about in the training. The start of it, the payout, and then when they've returned the cost of capital. Each company will have certain expectations of what cost of capital they need to receive and make in order to make that investment. So we have these different periods along a what we call the hockey stick of projects, big projects in the oil patch. Now, the rest of this was just running through the current Alaska system. And, Madam Chair, I'll try and speed through, but this is just to kind of run through.
We use every second we have.
Every second?
Yeah.
I'll keep going. We talked about, you know, it sounds simple. You start with revenue minus cost equals profit. But the way the Alaska one generally works is, you know, if we look at the box on the right, you try and get your revenue less any cost to get it to market. It comes back to whatever border your license or contract establishes. And then that's where you deduct things like your royalty and your allowed cost to get a taxable value. You assess any tax, and then that's where the oil company takes its profit. But we really start talking about, you know, what caused fiscal regimes to go from simple to complex. And a lot of times what happens, there are what I kind of deem some very fair, legitimate concerns that get put into legislation. There's some others that have, I'll get to it, that have some scale but may not be as important as some of the other aspects of what you go on. And usually what happens, as we talk about there in the third bullet, at 5,000 barrels a day, it's 182 million barrels a year. Mm-hmm. So it says every dollar that gets moved represents the movement of $182 million a year. if someone says they believe they see a loophole and 5 cents is moving somewhere or 10 cents is moving somewhere, and they try and plug it, they plug it because that's $9 to $18 million a year. That's a lot of money. But when you do a lot of those $9 to $18 million plugs here and there and here and there, over time, you create this very complex system. And now, when you really need to change something of significance, instead of just changing that one item of significance, you're having to change 12 or 15 things within your legislation and or regulations to make sure they all still hang together and are consistent. And we talked about it. Now, some of the legitimate things you have to worry about is when we start with revenue, everybody says, oh, that's pretty easy. That's just, let's take barrels times price. Well, then you have to get into what price am I using? Where was that determined? At the refinery in California, into the ship, out of the ship, into the pipe, out of the pipe, at the lease boundary. Okay, we establish within our regime where that's at. But then you have to establish, was it arm's length or non-arm's length? Did they sell to a third party where you're comfortable that the price paid was no more than should be paid and the price accepted was no less than should be accepted? Or was it sale with an affiliate? An affiliate sometimes has a, most people make the assumption if it's an affiliate, they can somehow transfer value in and out of a high tax regime to a low. So you'll generally take a look and monitor closely affiliated transactions. And then I'll add another layer of complexity. What's the definition of an affiliate? Is it 100%? Is it 51%? Is it something they control? Regimes sometimes just do away with just by defining something like 25% or more interest. It's an affiliate, and it's a non-arm's length that follows one set of rules. If it's under 25, it's third party, falls under a different set of rules. The same thing when we get into the barrels. The number of barrels that end up to the refinery is less than the barrels out of the well. There are legitimate losses and sometimes unknown losses that occur throughout the whole process. Whose barrels are they? Are the government barrels or the oil company barrels? And who suffers the loss of those? That can become quite contentious within some systems. So your system here is set up. It defines how to come up with the price and where that's at. It talks about when starting with the price, what you're allowed to deduct, such as the shipping and the taps, interfield pipelines, etc., and it defines how the barrels are to be counted. If we then go to 28, so when I've got now the barrels and the price, I put those two together, subtract the allowed transportation, and I then end up with the GVPP, or the gross value at the point of production. And then we start getting interesting. Now, if it's a GVR field and qualifies under the definition of GVR, then I take a GVR deduction, and it's the first way I start reducing the ultimate tax I'm going to pay because I get to reduce the amount of revenue that I have to claim. Then I subtract royalty. Now, I put a chart to the side. It's a couple years old. Ed King presented that to both bodies. And he presented just to show of a royalty on a certain type of land or water, how much of that royalty goes to the state central government, in this case the UGF or restricted, versus how much might go to somebody else. So think of it this way, that on state land it was an $8 royalty. So when you go down to MPRA and it's only $4.88, that means someone else is getting the other $3.12 and so forth going on down. So it's still an $8 royalty paid, just the state may not be getting it. So this is, remember earlier we said not all oil is created equal because of quality and other things. In a way you can apply this and say, in Alaska, all royalty is not equal. Mm-hmm. It may be of the same total dollar amount, but whose pocket it goes into varies depending on where that oil is produced.
And most of the restricted dollars there are going into the permanent fund. Just FYI for us, yeah, Alaskans to think about.
Thank you.
And Representative Lincoln.
And the source of the chart is with us, so thank you, Mr. King.
He's sitting in the back corner. I want to give him credit for it. Thank you. Then again, from that GVP, as we said, subtract GVR, subtract royalty, and then you subtract the cost of your operations. And this is where we said before, not all costs are deductible. The definition of direct, sort of versus overhead, you'll hear those terms used. Direct usually applies to what's going on in the field itself. So like if we're talking the North Slope, what's actually going on the slope, whereas overhead would be what's going on in Anchorage or down in Houston, or London or elsewhere. We understand deductions on equipment aren't allowed, even though a lot of money is spent until they show up in Alaska. Representative Spanholz, earlier you said, what type of things on timing can you do? Some regimes, for example, you may spend 2 years or 3 years building a platform somewhere. Some regimes allow those costs to be deducted, however they're deducted within that fiscal regime as you spend it. Other regimes don't allow you to deduct it until that equipment actually shows up in that country or in that regime. So that's another way in which the time element can come into play. And delaying for 2 years has a cost to the producer in carrying that money for those 2 years before they can allow their start the deductions. This is also where you get into carry forward. If you have any carry forward net operating losses, this is where you'd also bring them into the calculation.
Representative Hannah has a question. And then just as a time check, we have about 8 more minutes.
Okay, thank you. Through the chair, because of that example, present in the field and operational in specific, mm-hmm. and I believe it was Chevron who built a platform, brought it to Alaska. We had some weather delays. I don't think it ever went into production, then that turned around and it went away. So when you're saying allowing you to deduct it when you started construction, it was Shell.
Shell.
Versus in the field in Alaska, but it, you know, would it actually be operational before most people would allow that deduction? Or just it crossed the boundary and now it's here, so now you can deduct it even if it never operated?
Representative Hand through the chair. There's a presumption that everything's going to work, that companies aren't going to spend hundreds of millions of dollars on equipment that doesn't work. That doesn't mean 100% of the time.
Weather gets in the way.
Yeah. So, there's always the unknown that pops up. But for the most part, I would trust that if people are spending hundreds of millions, that it's going to work or they're going to make it work.
Please continue. And why don't we just try to do the last in the slides here, because there's just a handful more, and hopefully we'll have a minute or two for the last questions.
I'm not going to go through here, but after I do all those eligible deductions, I get to the production tax value, and this is where I subtract the tax. Now, I'm going to skip over the 7 ring fences and go here and say we're going to look at the North Slope, and you actually have to do 2 tax calculations all the time. One is a gross. So I look at the GVPP, or the GVPP minus the GVR, whichever is eligible, and I multiply by the appropriate gross tax rate. I then also have to do a net tax in that I then take that taxable value, I multiply by the 35%, and then I apply the appropriate sliding scale $0 to $8 a barrel credit or the fixed $5 per barrel for the GVR. And then I come up with both a gross tax payable and net tax payable, and then I take the greater of, and that becomes the tax that I'm obligated to pay. I've got some other commentary that if they got things they could deduct. I think one thing that was interesting to some people is we said even if people are, you know, we got the same companies on the slope, because of differential interest in the different fields and because of different activity in the different fields, there's no two of them paying the same amount of tax up there, even though they were getting the same prices in the same fields for their crude. Mm-hmm. It's just the nature of how everything comes together in sort of your blended ring fence of the North Slope. We then get after those, after the tax, we come down to the third bullet, what I call the oil company profit. I put it in quotes because that's not their profit yet. They then are subject to the payment of the appropriate income tax, both to Alaska if they are a C Corp, and then to the U.S. federal government. And finally, we get the money that goes into the oil company account. And last, we kind of had this driver. We talked about that. We talked about these, you know, 9 million catch here, 18 million catch there. You know, you create a lot of add-ons to your system that kind of adds to the complexity and difficult regulations. You got to make sure you don't mess up what you already have, but you accomplish what you're trying to do. And we get to what we call the unintended consequence. And that's a bit what we ran into on 111 when we want to take it from a tax credit to a carry-forward loss instead of a carry-forward tax credit. And then we got into the whole discussion of uplift, non-uplift, how far carry forward, et cetera. That's all part of when you got a lot of moving parts, it just gets to these unintended consequences.
and I finish.
Beautiful. Thank you. We have 3 minutes even for last questions. And I think Representative Lincoln, do you have a question?
No, I actually was going to make a comment that I think I'll save to a future meeting, but in the interest of time. But again, just want to thank the guests for spending time with us this week. I think I haven't been here for the majority of the time you spent with in Alaska helping us understand our fiscal policy. But if the past week has been any indication, you've had a pretty major impact on things up here. And I, as an Alaskan, I'm really appreciative of that. And just my last comment would be, as we think through these different regimes and possible changes, you know, the government take for a project that doesn't happen is zero. So we need to keep that in mind and always think about, you know, from the industry perspective. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. He's got the oil district, so he knows what's up. Any other thoughts or questions from committee members? Okay, well, I don't think this will be the last that we see of you, and appreciate the time and attention you're giving to everyone to get us all up to speed. And I don't know how long you're here in Alaska this time, and weather, it seems, is always a thing when you're here. So I just want to say safe travels, and we hope you have no hiccups in your journey home. So thank you again so much. Just a couple of reminders for committee members. On Wednesday, we do have a DNR budget subcommittee meeting before our regular committee, so we'll start at noon or as soon as the floor session allows us to get here. Please feel free to bring meal along for lunch. And then also the 1 p.m. amendment deadline for House Bill 27 for consideration on Wednesday. Thanks. With that, we will adjourn at 3:14. Thank you, everyone. Thank you.